I wonder just how long the rest of us can count on being free. They love our milk and honey, but they preach about some other way of living. When they're running down our country, man, they're walking on the back side of me. Yeah, walking on the back side of me. Running down the way of life, our fighting men have fought and died to keep. If you don't love it, believe it, let this song that I'm singing be a warning. When you're running down my country halls, you're walking on the fighting side of me. You're walking on the fighting side of me. Running down the way of life, our fighting men have fought and died to keep. If you don't love it, believe it, let this song
yes, when you're running down my country, you're walking down the fighting side of me. And that's the name of this program here on altrighttv.com or whiteresistanceradio.com. You can reach us through either route. In the battle for freedom, for free speech, for individual rights, we know, of course, we have a mortal enemies in the form of the radical left, the Antifa, the Jewish lobby, and so on. Much less obvious, though, among the enemies of freedom, are many corporations who have, and this is being as kind as possible, little appreciation for freedom. In many cases, a real hostility to freedom. And a pathetic willingness to appease the some of the most totalitarian elements in our society. I'd like to give you an example. Facebook, of course, regularly censors or right-wing or nationalist or white nationalist people, pages, etc., comments. In fact, last March, they announced that they would be banning white supremacists, whatever that is. And what white supremacy is usually an accusation made by the enemies of free speech and the enemies of the white race. It's very few people actually identify themselves as white supremacists. Well, then that wasn't enough for the censorship lobby, which in the United States primarily consisted of the ADL, or the Anti-Defamation League of B'nai B'rith. Now, they're actually not against defamation. They're defaming white people all the time. But they were the major agitators behind this. Well, then that announcement by Facebook didn't quite suffice. So Facebook went on to say, well, they'd also be banning white nationalists, again, whatever that might mean, or however that might be decided. Well, that's still not enough. The forces of censorship, the haters of liberty, want more, and that's what leads to this story. Now, Facebook is a free form. That is, you don't have to pay to post there. And you might think, well, that's because Mark Zuckerberg really likes it, really likes freedom. Well, nothing of the sort. Facebook is a great way to make money. And the way that, what happens there is that you are a... you basically are the market or the for a whole host of advertisers. Mark Zuckerberg delivers a very, very large market of potential consumers. And because of certain algorithms, that market can be subdivided. So to, as I understand, Facebook can perhaps deliver you a list of people, or deliver a list to advertisers of people in, let's say, the state of Kansas who are interested in automobiles, or are interested in NASCAR, or anything like that, or interested in knitting, for that matter. Well, that's valuable to advertisers. They can target just those people, and they pay good bucks for that. Well, that's kind of the background. Facebook makes mega bucks by selling advertising. Well, Facebook Incorporated is coming under mounting pressure from a growing list of advertisers who are pledging to pause their spending with the social media giant unless it does more to curb hate speech and misinformation on the platform. Now, what is hate speech? Well, it's speech that somebody hates. The movement among major brands and civil rights groups to boycott Facebook is gaining steam amid a global reckoning over systemic racism and an intensifying debate about the role that online platforms play in policing political speech as the United States heads toward a November presidential election. Online platforms, there's a battle over what online platforms should do to police political speech. Does anybody hear the First Amendment under attack? That's right. Scumbag minorities and corporate people who are complicit want to put a noose around the First Amendment and choke it to death. As of Thursday, nearly 100 advertisers have signed on to Stop the Hate for Profit, a nationwide campaign organized by the National Association of Colored People, that used to be the NAACP, National Association for the Advancement of Colored People, and the Anti-Defamation League. Certainly the latter, an absolutely mortal enemy of free speech. And other advocacy groups that ask companies to pull their spending from Facebook for the month of July. So it's a limited campaign. I guess it's a flexing of muscles, and if they can convince Mark Zuckerberg that he'll lose serious shekels from this, perhaps they will succeed. The campaign is fueled by concerns that the social media giant has not done enough to stop the spread of posts urging violence against people protesting anti-black racism and police brutality in the wake of the death of George Floyd. Now, don't think for one moment it's that tiny minority of people who urge violence. And depending on the jurisdiction, that can actually be breaking the law. If that's the case, well, the appropriate authorities can deal with that. Major brands that have announced plans to pull their advertising include Ben & Jerry's Ice Cream Company, clothing retailers The North Face, Patagonia and Eileen Fisher, and advertising firm Goodby Silverstein & Partners, whose clients include BMW and Pepsi. You know, if you are a shareholder or even just a consumer of Pepsi or BMW, if you're lucky enough to be that, or purchaser of North Face, get in touch with the company and say, I don't want you pulling advertising to try to stiff arm Facebook into censoring political speech. Because make no mistake about it, hate speech is just a smear for speech that some particular privileged group hates. There's no objective definition to it, of course. There is a risk to Facebook in the fact that Facebook gets more than 90% of its revenues from advertising, said Brian Sheehan, an advertising professor at Syracuse University and a former executive at global ad firm Saatchi & Saatchi, which is actually a Jewish law firm. advertising firm. Quote, if people don't feel that Facebook is controlling hate speech, and more brands feel that Facebook is a bad representation of their brand, it could hurt them. And so that's what it will come down to. Do these companies appreciate free speech? I think they've been, in most cases, hornswoggled into joining this campaign. Now, you've got to understand it's a limited campaign for 1 month. Whether it will succeed, we don't know. But you know, one of the things we have to be constantly on guard against are corporations who are prepared to betray basic principles like free speech and white interests. Well, here's a fascinating story out of Toronto. I reported last night on the problems that Rebel Media had when I went to do some interviews at Shanty Town in Nathan Phillips Square in Toronto. That's and the Antifa, some people of Black Lives Matter, some renegade Native Indians, and anarchists have set up what they call an autonomous zone, which means they don't want the police there. No, they're actually poaching, squatting on public property, setting up tents and so on. The collaborationist mayor of Toronto, John Tory, has let this continue. And when Rebel Media sent a reporter there a few days ago, he was accosted by some of the denizens of this autonomous zone. They shoved him. They tried to block the cameraman. The security guards, far from maintaining law and order or actually clearing the squatters away, now attacked the reporter and said he had to leave. And he said, but why don't you do something about the squatters? He quite rightly asked. No comment. And that's typical of the insolent bureaucracy and the insolent servants who are supposed to be securing our rights. Anyway, not only did they not do anything to prevent the assaults and menacing of the reporter and his cameraman, but they then ordered the reporter off city hall, city property, in the infelicitous words of the security guard, the reporter was trespassed. I'm going to trespass you. Well, trespass is an intransitive verb. That is, it does not take an object. It cannot take an object. I can't trespass you. Well, I can't trespass your property. I can trespass on your property, but anyway. So what they meant was give an order, and I believe it would be under the Trespass to Property Act, banning that reporter from City Hall property. I don't know if that would be for a year or just for a day or what, but anyway, the reporter continued to protest. The security personnel continued to be ignorant and belligerent in their behavior, and along came several Metropolitan Toronto Police, and you would think, well, they might intervene to secure the freedom of the reporter from Rebel Media to ask to interview people who might want to be interviewed, or at least consent to an interview among the protesters to try to find out what it was all about. And all the police did was to tell the reporter that they were escorting him off city property. They were not going to discuss the illegal occupation of that property. The reporter had been given a trespass notice, and it seemed to me it was only verbal, and was being escorted off. So the police, the City Hall security people, and the City Hall bureaucracy, right up to Mayor John Tory, aided and abetted this illegal takeover of public property, and interfered with freedom of movement on the part of the reporter, freedom of speech, and freedom of the press. Well, anyway, the rebel media raised some money to hire some security guards, and they decided to go back to the Antifa encampment or shantytown, and they've done a report, and I'm going to play this report for you. And it really is a shocker, as Ezra Levant, the president of Rebel Media, the director of Rebel Media, points out. And this is Rebel Media takes on the violent Antifa at Toronto City Hall. I'm going to try to play that for you now. As you know, my internet connection here in the mountains of British Columbia is not the best, so things are a little on the difficult side. And I'm still playing with with this anyway, while I try to get this see if we can't report this here. It really is a very good report, and it's a disgrace. What has happened? And the reporter was David Menzies. I'm hoping we can I can get that for you now. And see what we can do here. And this is the report from Rebel Media, which I hope we can finally get up here. It looks as though we might not be able to get that. I'm going to try another route. This is actually a brave confrontation. And it's pathetic, really, that the establishment has so collapsed in the face of the Antifa and various other privileged minorities threats. They simply refuse to enforce law and order. They let these thugs and entitled people occupy taxpayers' property in a way that they would not allow other people to do, and nor should they. In the episode I played you last night, some woman who identified as a Native Indian, and I have no way of knowing whether she was or not, but she said she was, said, "Get out of our country." He said that to the white reporter, David Menzies, "Get out of our country." Well, I don't think this sort of nonsense should be allowed to rest, to pass. No, it's not their country. They have a role in it, yes. They were here perhaps for the last 10,000 years. White people were here 10,000 years ago as well. What happened to them? Well, hard to know. Maybe we were genocided. But anyway, when white people returned in some numbers in the 16th century with Jacques Cartier, and he was not the first, but and there began to be French settlement and later on English settlement in eastern and central Canada. The Europeans overwhelmed the native Indians by numbers and by organization. And let's be very clear about this. The Indians were never the whatever they want to style themselves today, you know, First Nations or Aboriginals or whatever. They were never a united group. In fact, they were constantly warring. There was widespread slavery among the groups, and slaves usually being the unfortunate people who were captured in war, or if one tribe defeated another. There was very little development. There were no roads. There was no wheel. The only animal transport did not occur until well into the 17th century, when there were escaped horses, and some of the Plains Indians managed to domesticate them and use them to pull, not wagons. The Plains Indians had something called a travois, and that was basically two sticks lashed together at the top, like in a V, and sometimes with maybe strips of leather or something else across them, and goods would be piled on these, and these travois would be dragged. It makes a child's wagon look high tech. Now, this is not by means of trying to degrade anybody. It's a fact. The Native Indians were Stone Age people. That's a fact. This isn't a yuck yuck or anything. It's the truth. They were Stone Age primitive people. Yes, they should get some recognition or for having to some extent learn to adapt to an environment which, depending on where you were in Canada, could be fairly harsh. And they developed some techniques, and there were some small developments, the birch bark canoe, for instance. But they were no competition for Europeans, with a far more advanced technology, far more advanced weaponry, and a far greater civilization. Now, I know there might be people who'd shriek white supremacist. Well, it's interesting. I'm always intrigued with that accusation of white supremacy. As I mentioned before, I don't think many people who are white nationalists, like I am, would call ourselves white supremacists. I'm not interested in lording it over anybody else or exporting our ways to other countries. So from that point of view, of sort of an imperialist, I'm not one. But you know who recognizes white supremacy? I'll tell you. All the immigrants from the Third World who come to Canada and the United States and Europe by hook or by crook, they'll lie, they'll cheat, they'll scam, anything. Why? Why would you do that? Why would you come to a country that you will soon denounce as racist? Why? Because they don't take this stuff seriously. Not really. They don't really believe that we are racist and persecute them. We're the indulgent idiots who let them in. White supremacy? Well, actually, by choosing us, they're saying we are superior. Because there is a hard and fast rule in immigration. And I've studied immigration for many, many, many years. And it's, you know, it's very commonsensical. Nobody would willingly leave their country for a worse country. I mean, it's quite simple. Would you? Would you pick up stakes, leave people you knew and loved, familiar places and sounds and foods and all of that, to go halfway around the world to a place, to a new place that in many ways would be very foreign to you, if you didn't think it was better? Well, you wouldn't. I flip that around and say and give this example. How many people are lining up outside the embassy of Haiti? Or the embassy of Mali, or the or Burkina Faso, if you could even find that on a map, and saying, you know, I'm sick and tired of living in North America. I want to immigrate to Haiti, or to Burkina Faso, or to Mali. And well, okay, then ask yourself, well, why not? Why not? Why, on the other hand, are people trying to, by hook or by crook, to come in legitimately or scam their way into various countries in Western Europe, the United States and Canada and Australia and New Zealand? Why? Well, according to the immutable rule of immigration behavior, because they recognize they are better. Our countries are better. Or superior. Or the adjective doesn't quite fit, but supremacist. They're saying we're better. We don't have to say that. We don't have to, you know, stand on a platform and beat our chests and scream we're the best. We don't have to do that. By wanting to come here, hordes of people from failed countries, and they're failed because of failing and failed cultures. They want to come here because they recognize our culture, our countries are better. We've succeeded. Not perfectly, of course. I'd be the first to recognize that we have many drawbacks and faults. But, by comparison, in the minds of the newcomers, we are better. So by coming here, they've already settled that. So don't tire me with accusations of, you're a white supremacist. No. The people who've come here have already said we're superior. Because they've chosen to come here rather than stay in their own countries. Which would be a good idea. Or go to places like Haiti or Burkina Faso or Mali or any of a number of other hell holes, or what President Trump bluntly has called shithole countries. I mean, that's the reality. And to say that is not racist, it's realist. That's the reality. So, when this mouthy woman accosted the rebel media reporter and blasted or insolently told him, get out of our country. And he said, what do you mean, our? And she said, I forget which of the various euphemisms she used for Native Indian, but she said it was their country. Well, yeah, really. So, okay, well, actually, you lost out in the conquest. We overwhelmed you with numbers. We did not do, though, what many conquering people have done, and that's just basically genocided the indigenous people. Just wipe them out. We didn't. There have been hundreds of years of trying to accommodate them, granting them certain treaty rights, reservations, certain powers, certain exemptions, and of course, as I pointed out before, and it's a reality I think a lot of Canadians don't really realize exists. You don't, if you are a Native Indian living on a reserve, you do not pay income tax or sales tax. That's kind of a benefit. You can hunt and fish pretty much at all seasons without limits in most cases. Meanwhile, white people and other people, Chinese people, etc., have to get a hunting license and a fishing license, and there are certain restrictions that apply, or I should say many restrictions that apply. So all of this has been granted by the much-hated white man. When a person like that insolent Indian female says something like this, I would like to see people shoot right back. Well, okay, supposing the hated European withdrew everything that we gave you. All the things you benefit from, including that cell phone in your pocket, the pavement that you're walking on, you know, your people didn't never have pavement, the roads, the electricity that you use, in fact, just about everything you see around you. If you know, hypothetically, we could take this all back and leave you with what you had. My guess is you wouldn't survive a year. I know we are close to the land, blah, 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 blah. Yeah, but the hunters and gatherers and so on, I don't think would last too long. Oh, yeah, of course, the rifles would have to go because that came from Europeans. They came from Europeans. You'd be back to bows and arrows and spears. Maybe some form of slingshot. Within a year, to survive, you'd have to make a deal with other people. So you wouldn't make a deal anymore with the hated Europeans, so make a deal with the Chinese. They'd be glad to come in, give you initially some sustenance, and take over the land. Don't think, though, they would put up with your nonsense. We are the First Nations. No, they would say, we're the rulers. Look at the way minorities are treated in Red China. The brutality inflicted on the Tibetans, the re-education concentration camps into which over a million Muslim Uyghurs in the western province of Xinjiang have been thrust. No, it wouldn't be too pretty. You proved yourself incapable of securing this land in the face of European settlement. There's no reason to think that if we were to withdraw all of our technology that you so despise, that you never invented, that you would last. And I think a year would be at the outside. Well, here's a column that appeared the other day. The idea of calling the police terrifies me now. And the lamestream media has been great at pumping out anti-police, pro-minority, pro-Black Lives Matter propaganda. Well, this is by Philip Moskovich. He's a writer and audio producer in Halifax and deals with mental health issues. "Don't call the police," my son said over the phone, near tears, his voice sounding desperate. "The police kill people with mental illness all the time." His mom and I had called the police on him before. We called them when he disappeared during a psychotic break, when he refused to comply with an involuntary hospitalization order, and when he left the hospital on a temporary pass and refused to go back. Now, he's an adult, apparently. We called them when he was unwell and tried to hitchhike out of the province with no money or possessions. Twice he was apprehended, and we watched him twist and struggle before police wrestled him to the ground and took him away. Their mentally ill son doesn't want the police called. But they've had to call him. We did this knowing that he'd had traumatic experiences with the police in the past. In 2013, I'd watched on live stream as he was arrested by the RCMP in New Brunswick at the protest. I saw him struggle, resisting before being shoved into a cruiser and driven off to be charged. Well, you know, if he's going to struggle and resist arrest, yeah, he's going to be in trouble. That was horrifying, but also seemed different. Horrifying? Well, why can't you get the mentally ill person to obey? And this Moskovich goes on to say, surely the police who respond to people experiencing mental health issues wouldn't behave like this. I was so naive. Then I heard of wellness checks. But police kill people during wellness checks. They kill people with mental illness, as my son said all the time. Now, that's a wild exaggeration. Your son you're as nutty as your son. The police have shot people because of their violent and erratic behavior. They don't kind of knock on the door and say, "Are you feeling okay? You're all right?" And then bang, 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 you shoot them. He ticks off several other issues. On June 20th, Peel Regional Police were called to a home in Mississauga for a wellness check on a 62-year-old Ejaz Chowdhury. They shot and killed him. That's not quite the whole story. Ejaz Chowdhury apparently was armed. He'd been called on, the police, his family had called on numerous previous occasions when he had meltdowns. He was paranoid. He was schizophrenic. He didn't speak much English, at least according to his nephew. And he didn't like the police. He was scared of the police. And they'd had previous run-ins with him. They tried for 3 hours to negotiate with him, discuss things with him, which would, and then only when he went silent for about half an hour, did they burst into his apartment. We're not quite sure what happened, and that will probably eventually be revealed, but he ended up being shot. But this is not a matter of police going around hunting mentally ill people to blow them away. These are people who behave violently, who in a better society, in the society we used to have, would probably be in mental asylums where they could be controlled and prevented from harming others and themselves until such time as they recovered, if indeed they did recover. And he concludes this, 5 years, this is a Philip Moskovich, 5 years ago when our son was diagnosed with mental illness, my partner and I were bewildered, frightened, and confused. He goes on to say that the partner, you know, is anybody married? I mean, or is that the new word for your wife? By the way, Moskovich's partner realized that the son was more than they could handle and called the police on numerous occasions. What are the police to do? Now, it's suggested that, well, instead of calling the police, they should call mental health experts. Right? There's probably a role for them. But if they show up, and the person is violent and lunges at them with a knife, these people are not, the mental health experts are not armed. They're not trained for dealing with a violent person. What do they do? And this, of course, is not mentioned in the ongoing trashing of police forces. Well, this is Paul Fromm, and you're on the fighting side of me. going to take a musical break now, and going to play a medley by one of the great entertainers. Well, actually, this is not the one I wanted. We do have our problems, and I must apologize for that. This is Boxcar Willie. Boxcar Willie, a great entertainer, and this is a medley of Hank Williams songs. You'd think that we're starting the program again. We're going to try to get this again. This is a. We're going to try to get. This poor internet connection really is a problem. This is I'm going to try to play a song here by Gretchen Wilson called "Politically Uncorrect." No, we're still trying battle to get this. The song for you. That's of course our sign-off tune, and this is, I hope, Gretchen Wilson and "Politically Uncorrect." No, this is not going to be politically uncorrect. Again, thank you for your indulgence. Merle Haggard, of course, is a great entertainer, brings to the his music and songs a real appreciation for the values of the working man, and I think we might have.
Must come down.
A trip to the grocery store
politically
or a tank of gas. It's a family farm that's been in the family for over 100 years, being sold here in Arkansas.
And it will be occasionally interrupted here.
About the violence in the day.
Seems like I have, less money to spend.
Another deadly day in Iraq has 11 U.S. soldiers.
I'm for the low man on the totem pole.
Yeah.
nothing wrong with the plan.
Nothing wrong with the working man.
Here's one of the best songs of Gretchen Wilson, a talented and spirited entertainer who hit the music scene about 15 years ago. And this is...
Physical distancing slows the spread of COVID-19.
This is some propaganda I'm not being able to excise here. I think we've... Wilson, Redneck Girl. Here's another one by Gretchen, Here for the Party. Another one of her big hits.
Mm-hmm.
another Here for the Party by Gretchen Wilson. There's one more by Gretchen. At least we think there's one more by Gretchen here.
I ain't never had a problem with California.
This is California Girls, Gretchen Wilson.
And, putting around in your size zeros, skinning in her bones, no meat on the bones. Ever even heard of George Jones? Ain't you glad we ain't all California girls? Ain't you glad there's still a few of us that know how to rock your world?
Wilson, California Girls. This is Paul Fromm. You're on the fighting side of me. Back with you again tomorrow, same time. And, of course, you can reach us on altrighttv.com or lightresistanceradio.com. And I sign off tonight, as I always do, with the anthem of the real Canada, the Maple Leaf Forever. And this is Paul Fromm, and you're on the fighting side of me. Glad to have you with us, and of course I do apologize for the slight technical glitches that we've experienced along the way. This is Paul Fromm, and you're on the fighting side of me here on altrighttv.com or whiteresistanceradio.com.
Did you know that behind Canada's opioid epidemic appears to lie a carefully planned strategy by a hostile foreign power? Every year, over 4,000 Canadians.
Together, together. not.